deadlines. The Syrian army says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli attack on the cities of Damascus and Homs. A confidential UN document accuses the Taliban of intensifying a search for people who worked with US and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Also ahead, Burkina Faso's government says 80 people have been killed in a militant attack against a convoy of civilians and military personnel in the north of the country. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story, the Syrian army says the country's air defenses have repelled an Israeli attack on the cities of Damascus and Homs. The army reported that the Israeli fighter jets launched missiles from Lebanese airspace. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who gave us more details.
At about 11 p.m. local time here in Syria, a loud sound of Syrian air defenses being activated was heard by the residents of the capital. Then an official military source in Damascus gave out a statement confirming that it was an Israeli attack and giving some details, saying that Israeli fighter jets carried out an aerial attack using a number of missiles from the direction of southeastern Lebanon, meaning this attack, as usual, Israel used Lebanese airspace in attacking Syria. Now, the Israeli fighter jets attacked areas around the Syrian capital, Damascus, and other areas around the central city of Homs. According to the official military source in Syria, Syrian air defenses were able to intercept the missiles and shoot down most of them. And currently, the statement concluded the Syrian army is assessing the damages or the results of the attack.
More than 50 U.S. Democratic lawmakers have urged President Joe Biden's administration to ensure that Israel and Egypt allow humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. In a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the lawmakers in the House of Representatives described the humanitarian situation in Gaza as, quote, untenable. They said the recent tensions between the Israelis and the Palestinians have left an estimated 1.3 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. The lawmakers noted that people in Gaza currently have severely limited access to clean water, food, medicine, and electricity. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The crippling siege has brought Gaza's economy to its knees. The Lebanese president says the delay in the formation of a new government is due to politicians' increasing demands from Prime Minister-designate Najib Da'iz Meqati. Michel Aoun expressed concern that the goal of the demands was to force Meqati to resign, which Aoun said he does not want. On Tuesday, Meqati described forming a government for Lebanon as a difficult arithmetic equation. He made the comment after a meeting with Aoun at the presidential palace. Lebanon's ruling elites have failed to form a new cabinet since Prime Minister Hassan Diab quit following last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port. Mariam Saleh has reviewed the reports by local Lebanese media about the demands different political factions are making for the upcoming government. Take a listen to that.
There was a lot of talk in the media just yesterday and today, but both the Prime Minister designate and the President considered them as false claims. Some media said that President Aoun wants veto power, so he was calling and demanding for at least 9 or 10 ministers that are close to the President, or for some people they believe they are loyal to President Michel Aoun's group, which is the Free Patriotic Movement. Others are saying that the Prime Minister designate is trying to, or very much close to, the former Prime Ministers Saad Hariri and Fuad Sanyura and others, in order to try to gain some gains from this a cabinet which will live by, as some are saying, live by American and Saudi standards. All of this would not lead to the fact that we can certify that there will be a cabinet anytime soon. We are waiting to see if there will be any talks in the upcoming days. If not, early next week, we either have a cabinet or we have the prime minister designate stepping down.
A confidential UN document says the Taliban, contrary to their claims, are intensifying a search for people who worked with the United States and NATO forces. According to the document, the Taliban has priority lists of individuals it wants to arrest. The report says the people most at risk are the ones who had central roles in the Afghan military, police, and intelligence units. It notes that the Taliban have been conducting targeted door-to-door visits of individuals they want to apprehend. The document, reported by AFP, was written by the Norwegian Center for Global Analyses, an organization that provides intelligence to UN agencies. The Taliban, which came to power last week, pledged the full amnesty for all who worked with the former Afghan government. Turkey says it will act in a coordination with the international community in its stance on the recognition of the new government in Afghanistan. Roshan Sagnam is in Istanbul.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan, Iran has seen a steady influx of Afghan refugees. Iran's border police have set up temporary camps alongside the country's eastern border to host the inbound refugees. Yusuf Jalali was there and filed this report from the Iranian-Afghan border.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran. Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak crossing point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
The death toll from an attack on a convoy of soldiers escorting civilians in Burkina Faso has risen to 80. In a statement, the government detailed that 59 civilians, 6 militiamen, and 15 military officers were killed in the attack. Security forces said dozens of militants were also killed. The attack happened on Wednesday when militants opened fire on the convoy near the town of Arabinda in the country's north. Now, the incident is the latest in a series of attacks across the West Africa's Sahel region this month. On Monday, armed men killed 37 civilians, including 14 children, in an attack on a village in Niger. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have joined other Muslims worldwide in marking Ashura. Danjuma Abdullahi filed this report from Nigeria.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless act that field, in which Imam Hussein and his whole household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and it's a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be honest in all our believing, to commit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said 2 people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Muslims residing in Italy have commemorated Ashura, which marks the martyrdom anniversary of the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Max Javidi is in Rome.
The 10th day of Muharram has been a day of mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein ibn Ali, also in Italy. Faithfuls from across the Italian peninsula met at Rome's Imam Mahdi Islamic Center to honor the Battle of Karbala and remember the sacrifices of the Imam Hussein, whose death is considered a symbol of the struggle against tyranny and injustice.
I have goosebumps when Ashura comes, and I move to tears when I listen to Imam Hussein's words. I always take my children to the Ashura ceremonies. I want them to understand what Imam Hussein did for us.
Ashura is everything to me. Ashura is death, rebirth, life. We have to follow Imam Hussein's example, the way he stood against his enemies, who were nothing but traitors.
The Ashura commemoration at the Imam Mehdi Islamic Center has been attended by Shia Muslims coming from a number of countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, India, and Moldavia.
Many at the Imam Mehdi Center here in Rome believe Ashura is not just a day in history. They are of the idea that Iran's consistency in resisting hegemony is rooted precisely in the culture of Ashura.
Our resistance to hegemonic plans is great thanks to the legacy of Imam Hussein. Active opposition to hegemony is possible through resistance at the level of everyday life. In fact, our faith reflects a model that can serve all societies.
Celebration at the Imam Mehdi Islamic Center have included performing tajieh, cooking various kinds of food and distributing it among the attendants, and a final speech by Sheikh Abbas Di Palma, in which he remembered the Battle of Karbala and the attack and the killing of Imam Hussein. Max Civili, Rome.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ashura, history's most heartrending tragedy. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the anniversary of the most heartrending event the world has ever seen, and which, despite the passing of a millennium, 3 centuries and 82 years, continues to interact with human conscience in every age and era to guide people and nations towards reforms and the quest for social justice based on dignity. Stay with us for an exclusive feature in this regard. O Allah, exalted is your station, great is your power, and stupendous your might. You have no need of the creatures, your supremacy is all-embracing, and you have the power to do whatever you wish. Your mercy is near, your promise is true, your blessings are plenteous, and your tests are beautiful. I call you in the hour of my need and beseech you in the moment of my destitution. I turn to your help in my weakness and put my trust in you as being sufficient for me. Judge between us and our people with justice, for indeed they have dealt with us deceitfully and treacherously, forsaken us and betrayed us and spilled our blood, though we are the progeny of your prophet and the offspring of your beloved Muhammad ibn Abdullah, whom you chose for your apostleship and trusted with your revelation. The passage that you heard are excerpts from the famous supplication recited by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, on the day of his martyrdom in Karbala, in 10th of Muharram, 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD. Today, in spite of the worldwide spread of the coronavirus pandemic, the faithful continue to commemorate, of course, with due medical precaution and social distancing, history's most blood-curdling tragedy. It is the immortal saga of the grandson of the Seal of Divine Messengers that is commemorated not just in the land where he was treacherously martyred, but all over the world, wherever are found the devout followers of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We use the term devout followers since devotion is the highest degree of love and affection for the Prophet's person and his God-given position, coupled with practical adherence to his way of life and teachings, that is, Sunnah and Sirah. Moreover, without devotion, the mere claim to be a follower could be dubious, as is clear from the words of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the supplication that he and the other members of the Prophet's family were the victims of the treachery and deceit, not of adherents of other creeds, but of those styling themselves as Muslims. It is an irony of Muslim history that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, as a member of the Immaculate Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity God has vouched in the Noble Quran in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab, and decreed love and affection for them as token of a believer's gratitude to the Prophet for enlightening him or her with the message of Islam, as is evidenced by Ayah 23 of Surah Shura, was slain on the orders of a person claiming to be the political heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus, although the day of Ashura and the mourning ceremonies of Muharram and the subsequent month of Safar might be expressions of devotional grief by the faithful and renewal of their allegiance to Imam Hussein, ideals of justice and refusal to bow to tyranny, this annual commemoration definitely raises questions in the minds of conscientious non-Muslim observers. They ask how Yazid and the Umayyad regime clung to the apex of power of the Islamic realm since as late as 8 AH and the fall of Mecca 2 years before the Prophet's departure from the world. Yazid's father Muawiyah and grandfather Abu Sufyan were hardcore heathens, never missing an opportunity to strike at Islam and Muslims. And if it is claimed that Umayyad rule was legitimate and as per the commandments of God in the Noble Quran and the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, then what unpardonable offense had Imam Hussein, peace upon him, committed to deserve such a tragic death along with 18 other male members of the Prophet's family, including his 6-month-old infant son? Both Muslims and non-Muslims owe to ponder on these questions. If the verdict is in favor of the righteousness of the stand of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and against Yazid and his Umayyad hordes, then they should be true to their conscience and probe in a diligently scientific manner as to what went wrong after the passing away of the Prophet, that a tragedy of such a bestial magnitude occurred in Karbala, which did not even spare the women, folk, and children of the Prophet's household from imprisonment. It is an irony of Islamic history that in 19 AH, corresponding to 640 AD, Muawiyah was given the governorship of the vast province of Sham, made up of today's Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, including the illegal entity called Israel. In the subsequent years, Muawiyah, who is on record as saying that every time the Muazzin recites the Prophet's name in the Azan, he feels intense hatred deep down in his heart, came out in open armed rebellion against Imam Ali, peace upon him. He next intimidated and bribed the Iraqis to betray Imam Hassan, peace upon him, so as to seize the caliphate in 41 AH, corresponding to 661 AD. Then, in violation of the clauses of the treaty with the elder grandson of the Prophet, whom he martyred through a fatal dose of poison in 50 AH or 670 AD, he nominated the libertine Yazid as his successor in 60 AH. These are the bitter realities of Muslim history that climaxed at Karbala in 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD, where only the sacrifice on such a grand scale by the Prophet's younger grandson could salvage Islam. It ripped off the mask of hypocrisy from the face of Yazid, for the tyrant and Singh, the head of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in a tray before him, burst out saying that he had avenged his heathen ancestors killed in the battles of Badr and Uhud, which his grandfather Abu Sufyan had imposed on the Prophet and Muslims. It should now be clear that the killers of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, were not Jews, not Christians, not Hindus, not Zoroastrians, not Buddhists, not shamanists, not pagans, and not atheists, but people who called themselves Muslims and knew him very well with full knowledge that he was a paragon of virtue. Most of them had heard, either directly or indirectly from their elders, the Prophet's immortal phrase, "An al-Husayn misbahul huda wa safinatun najat," whose English rendering is, "Indeed, Hussein is the beacon of guidance and the ark of salvation." For the true believers, this wasn't the dotting of a middle-aged grandfather, especially when God says that his prophet neither errs nor speaks out of desire, and it is nothing but revelation revealed, as the Noble Quran says in ayahs 2 to 4 of Surah Najm. Perhaps some of the prophet's companions who before becoming Muslims had spent the greater part of their life worshipping idols and indulging in all sorts of cardinal sins might not have properly gauged the words of the seal of divine messengers regarding his grandson or the rest of his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity the Noble Quran vouches. If they had, Islamic history would have been spared of the greatest ever discord as a result of their violation of divine commandments. If they had, 50 years after the Prophet's departure, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, would not have been so tragically martyred. Now we understand why the Prophet used to say in such explicit words, "Hussein minni wa ana min al-Hussein." Hussein is from me and I am from Hussein. We also begin to comprehend his other immortal phrase regarding his two grandsons, "Al-Hasan wal-Husayn Sayyidai Shababu Ahlul Jannah." Hassan and Hussein are the leaders of the youth of paradise. Thus it becomes obvious to us what Imam Hussein, peace upon him, means and to whom he refers in his supplication to God, cited at the start of the program, when he speaks of the treachery, deceit, and betrayal of the Ahlul Bayt. Ashura and the Ziyarat we recite on this day have drawn the clearest line between the truth and falsehood for the guidance of human societies. For on this day, blood triumphed over naked swords to jolt human conscience and present to mankind the most endurable barometer for ascertaining one's faith. The day of Ashura thus freshens up our memories every year of the heroic stand of the Prophet's grandson who refused to give his hand in allegiance to a tyrant by preferring the glory of martyrdom to an abject life under an oppressive and corrupt system. Here is a passage from the famous Ziyarat, for salutation to Imam Hussein, peace upon him, on this day. "O Abu Abdullah,
Your martyrdom was a great calamity and the cause of great distress for us and all followers of Islam. It was a tremendous calamity that befell the heavens and which affected all the denizens of the heavens. May Allah's curse be on those who instituted a regime of wrongdoing and injustice against you, Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's curse be on those who sideline you from your rightful station and whittle from you the status that Allah had assigned you. May Allah's curse be on those who slew you, and may His curse be on those who paved the way for them, making it possible to wage war against you. Before God and you, I repudiate them, their supporters, their followers, and those who befriend them. Food for thought. Our heartfelt condolences to all on the fateful day of Ashura, when Imam Hussein, peace upon him, while glancing over the army of Yazid in Karbala and seeing Umar ibn Sa'd ordering his forces to attack him, had said, "This day Allah has permitted us to engage in jihad, and He shall reward us for our martyrdom. So prepare yourself to fight against the enemies of Islam with patience and resistance. O sons of the noble and self-respected persons, be patient, for death is nothing but the bridge which you must cross after facing trials and tribulations so as to reach heavens and its joys. Which of you do not like to go from this prison of the world to the lofty palaces of paradise?"
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
When we go through this book, we find that Mr. Azizullah Tarudi is trying to collect every sentence quoted regarding Imam Hussein alayhi salam or from Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the books.
For example, if you want to read something about Imam Hussein, you don't know where to find it, which book you can find the information you are looking for. But Musnad stands for compiling everything which is related to Imam Hussein.
Familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher you are listening to. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Let me express my condolences on the occasion of martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and his great companions.
Thank you very much. May all your azadaris, dear listeners, and your majalis be accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. For today's discussion, we want to talk about an author who dedicated one of his most outstanding works to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He is no one but the late Azizullah Attarudi and his magnum opus or work, Musnad al-Imam al-Shahid Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Sheikh Ziyainia, let's start with you for this episode. What information can you give us about the late Azizullah Attarudi? He might not very much known in the English world and the English language, but books that he wrote in the Arabic language are famous, and the type of look that he had at Imam al-Hussein's movement is really outstanding. Talk a little bit about him for us.
Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The late figure Azizullah Attarudi was born in a village close to the city of Quchan in Iran. And from his very young age, he dedicated his time to his study.
That's right.
I mean, when he was 5 years old, he started his study. And first he was studying in his village and then moved to Quchan and then Mashhad.
That's right.
And after that, he moved to Najaf al-Ashraf. But because he was facing with some disease and he couldn't tolerate the weather of Najaf.
That's right. Especially during the summers, which is hot.
Yes.
That's right.
So he couldn't continue. He just stayed in Najaf something like a year or 2 years and then returned to Iran again.
That's right.
And he is one of the figures who dedicated his time, we mentioned fully dedicated his time, to revise the books of Shia school of thought.
That's right.
First of all, he started to work with marhum, the late Mr. Ali Akbar Ghaffari.
That's right.
That I believe he is again another figure that okay. is unknown to us.
Yes.
But many of our books are published by his efforts.
Really? Okay.
So Mr. Attarudi started his work with Mr. Ghaffari.
That's right.
In publishing the book of Al-Kafi.
That's right.
He was correcting the errors in this mm-hmm. book.
That's right.
And did a very prominent job. Then he started working by his own in some other fields.
You mean by correcting the errors is revising some parts?
Yes, yes, because okay. Al-Kafi was published,
okay.
but some errors were okay. in the published mm-hmm. you know, version.
Yes.
So he was the figure who corrected these errors.
That's right. Okay.
But after that, he dedicated his time to be a figure as a codicologist. So he was revising some, you know, manuscripts. And after being experienced in this field,
that's right.
he felt this necessity that he should, you know, compile the ahadith of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, each of them in a separate
volume
or separate complex.
That's all right.
So this is the story of the compiling Masanid al-A'imma alayhi salatu wasalam, that he had this tawfiq and chance to compile for each of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam an individual musnad.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, what more information do we have about the, it's called the background of the late Azizullah Attarudi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to add top of the information that my dear brothers mentioned, that he dedicated his life in order to publish Islamic books and revising all Islamic books that we had. It is very interesting that he made a kind of trip for 15 countries out of his pocket, not benefiting from the public money, not benefiting or being supported by any entity, but out of the curiosity that he had for Islamic corpus and refreshing and enhancing Islamic corpus that we had,
he did such a travelings and trips. So for the first of all, he stayed in Mecca and Medina for a couple years, and after that he went to different countries like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, okay, Yemen, Egypt, and so forth that I mentioned more than 15 countries. Yeah,
was this to collect the books, you mean, or
to complete his works and get more information? Because through the countries that he traveled to, we can see the name of the European countries. So what is the reason? Definitely, okay, the reason is the enriched library that we have, for example, in England or Italy or Germany.
That's right.
Because we know all of the libraries which are
the original manuscripts of some of the most outstanding authentic Islamic books are still kept over there. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Since one of the main works that he was doing was to do a kind of comparative studies through different manuscripts in order to revise.
Oh, very good.
The published work.
As Sheikh Ziaini also said, he was a codicologist.
Yeah, definitely.
In the true sense of the word.
In need of doing such comparative study for the original manuscripts available in different libraries all around the world.
That's right, very good.
So he had really dedicated his life in order to do a kind of favor for Muslim ummah.
That's right.
That is something that I think we have to mention with respect to the personality of late Attaruddi.
Attaruddi, that's all right.
Standing on and on. Blaze, alone here I stand, with no one left to embrace. Both my feet are being burned by the sand, and fire scorches my face. Today someone else's pain I understand. Today her steps are retraced. Of our flame to burn, so they burnt all the tents of her children. On each one a scar. I remembered Zahra. I remembered
when I heard Hussein to Abbas crying, "Brother, my back is broken." I remembered the sound of something breaking when Zahra's rib was taken. When I saw him from the river returning, looking pale and shaken, I remembered by Zahra he'd be wailing, "Oh mother, please awaken. Oh mother."
And, you know, this has been the habit of most of the ulama. I've heard that Allama Amini also was traveling to different parts of the world, the Arab countries, also the Indian subcontinent, in order to look at the very manuscript of the works. And, the surprising news is that sometimes they could not provide a copy, but they were ready to write down the whole book with their own handwriting, okay? And this made, I think, the work very much greater. Azizullah already was one of them. Sheikh Ziaini, let's get to the book, Musnad al-Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. What is Musnad exactly? Because this term Musnad might be understood as two different concepts, maybe, is it?
Yes, we have two different concepts of Musnad. The first one, that is the old one also, is a kind of book that is collecting all of ahadith regarding a narrator and all of his ahadith and narrations are collected in a book.
That's right.
For example, we have Musnad al-Imam al-Hanbal. This is the first type of book. But the second type of Musnad is the book in which narrations are quoted, that these narrations are quoted from a single figure, but the narrator is not a person. Maybe many different narrators are mentioned in the book.
That's right.
But the author of this second type of Musnad is trying to compile every single words of the figure.
Okay.
The figure whom which the book is compiled for.
That's right.
Musnad al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is of the second type of Masanid.
Okay.
So when we go through this book, we find that Mr. Azizullah Tarudi is trying to collect every sentence quoted regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the books.
That's right.
And you know, this is really a hard work to be done.
Yeah, huge work, that's right.
Yes. And we must also have this in our consideration, that in our mind, that Mr. Azizullah Tarudi has done this great effort at the time that he didn't have any computer. So
yes.
One of the reasons that he had to travel so much was this issue, that they didn't have any internet.
That's right.
They didn't have any computer. So he had to travel,
yes,
to stay at some libraries.
Right.
For example, once he traveled to India and stayed there for 3 years.
Wow.
3 years is not, you know, something to be...
It is not a short stay in a village and enjoying the weather.
And it's really hard.
Yeah, it's hard, man.
It's really hard.
Okay.
So I want to mention this point, that Mr. Azizullah Tarudi is a very good example for this Farsi expression, that rahro onast ke aheste va peyvaste ravad.
Very good.
The one who is going forward is the one that is going slowly, but continuously.
But continuously, that's right.
So he is a very, very good example for this expression.
That's right. And through this Musnad of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he collected all the narrations or sentences of Imam al-Hussein and the statements according to authentic resources, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziya.
You're welcome. Thank you
for your presence in the program, the teacher, and Sheikh Mahdavi. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
May Allah help us to be among the faithful followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's teachings and his trainings, and may Allah bless the soul of the late Azizullah Atarudi. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Please accept again our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications and azadaris in the majalis and the takaya that you go during these days in the month of Muharram. You can visit our website for more information on this program and our previous episodes, and download them for free at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and another dignitary and famous personality of Shia world, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alaik, ya Aba Abdullah.
In 680 AD, on Ashura, the 10th day of the holy month of Muharram, Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad and the third Imam of Shia Muslims, was murdered in the desert of Karbala, located in contemporary Iraq. Since then, Shia Muslims commemorate his martyrdom every year. This year, as the coronavirus pandemic rages on, governments and health authorities are cautioning people to commemorate the event with strict health guidelines. In Bahrain, however, Shia Muslims have not been cautioned but banned from holding Muharram mourning rituals on the surface for the pandemic. But critics say the truth is far beneath the surface.
الحادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Restrictive measures increased in Bahrain in the run-up to Muharram this year, some of them under the pretext of preventing COVID-19 from spreading. The major organizers of mourning rituals in Bahrain have reportedly been summoned and threatened by the authorities. Some religious centers have been warned that in case of hosting Muharram rituals, they will be fined and shut down for 3 years. The security apparatus has also had some local media publish articles against organizing mourning ceremonies. Bahrain's most prominent Shia cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qasim, has condemned Manama's decision to ban mourning ceremonies in Muharram, deploring the double standard that the ban has been introduced while business centers, markets, pools, and sports clubs have reopened in Bahrain.
It's obviously hypocrisy to a greater extent, but at the same time you can see that they are playing to their masters. Okay, the things that please their masters is having their pools and gambling venues and all of those kinds of things, but also they want to make sure that the economy does not suffer.
The discrepancy between policies shows how Manama is using the pandemic as an excuse to target Shia rituals during Muharram. The Al Khalifa regime is accused of systematically discriminating against the country's Shiite community, which accounts for the majority of Bahrain's population. Discriminatory practices affect Shia Muslims across a vast array of issues, including employment, freedom of expression, and political rights. The Shia community faces exclusion from the military and security apparatuses, the arbitrary revocation of Bahraini citizenship, and the denial of medical care for prisoners.
Their human rights are violated basically in every form, whether it be education, their employment rights, whether it be the rights to secure best standard of life. That's what they've done. They've treated the Shia Muslims in Bahrain as second-class citizens. They've made sure that they don't have any rights to the best standard of anything. The reason why they're doing that, it's pretty clear, is that, if they gave them all the rights and stuff.
The Bahraini monarchy has historically used alleged ties between Shia opposition groups and Iran to justify the systematic denial of political rights. As demonstrated by the Bandar Gate scandal, the public revelation of a report on the regime's plan to marginalize the Shiite community